There are a number of things on on my agenda this evening, and some of them I'll tell you as we go along. One of them I'll tell you right. Somebody said, please define politics. I didn't find a dictionary. I didn't really look very hard. But I thought of what the word probably means, and polis, of course, is the city or group of people that are organized in some way, and I think it's the art of governing. Art in the Greek sense of doing rather than knowing. So that's a kind of broad definition, and I'm using it to mean any actions required for government, lawmaking, policy setting, negotiating, taking care of the polis's defenses, economic stability, the like, things of that kind. So that kings and local mayors are all politicians. And where you have administration necessary in an organization, you have some kind of politics going on, whether it's a school or a church or a new church. And, well, I understand there's quite a bit of that. It's very difficult, actually. There has to be some politics in the best sense, and that always leaves room for some politics in the not-so-wonderful sense, given human nature. But when you merge three organizations, obviously there are things that have to be done. People who had offices may not have offices. A lot of things. Schools may need to merge. You know what sorts of things there are. And those are political problems. So I hope that helps a little bit for the people who want to know what I meant by politics as governing. And that can be done for the good of the common, for the common weal, or it can be done for one's self-aggrandizement, or it can be done in some mix of those two things. So it isn't a dirty word in itself. It's a very strong, good word. But we've become a bit pessimistic about it, I think. What I'm going to be doing tonight, well, wait, before I do that, I've got a harder question for you all. I don't expect you to answer it, but we might discuss it this evening. What's religion? Nobody teaches religion has been able to come up with a definition that satisfies everyone. That's a toughie. Another one that's difficult is spiritual. What's spiritual? And it's a word that's a pretty good word. It's a bit appropriated sometimes. I wonder how appropriately. But my definition is a working definition, and there are others, and I would repeat it as a personal and deep appropriation of one's religion in such a way as to be united or very close to the divinity, so that that union influences behavior. It's always been a touchstone of spirituality. One can feel as spiritual as anything, but if it doesn't bear fruit, then one wonders about its depth and reality. Just as I think Luther taught you to judge one's faith by the fruits that it produces. More or less. So, something of that kind. It is not the feeling or emotion, although that may attend it. I think it's terribly important for people to understand that. It can exist in conditions of dryness and lack of feeling of any kind where trust and faith really are dominant and not supported by emotion, and that's very important too. We'll come back to that, but I thought it might be helpful to clear that up. But what I want to do tonight is get away, actually it's not the 20th century yet, we're going to do that tomorrow, but to look at the 16th century with a definite purpose, and that is to get away from our own problems and context of religion and politics and look at what it meant in the lives of people in that century. And so we're going to move out in space and back in time to a little village across the border from France. It's a place I've been studying for 12 years. And I've read a lot of, not only books about it, but correspondence, 16th century letters, mostly of highly placed people, but also of people in the town who are just the bourgeois, the citizens of the town. And I have created a couple of people who live there, Angelique and Pierre. And I want to look at the events of the Reformation from their perspective. Something I really haven't done too much, although gradually as I've been creeping into it. As I told somebody today, I started as a theologian and an historian of theology or history of ideas type person, and have just been unable to avoid the historical, political, sociological consequences of theology in the 16th century, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing tonight. On the 20th century, it's a little different story. But at any rate, we take Angelique and Pierre as two middle-class people. I decided they're farmers and cheesemakers, I think because I had a real fixation on cheese all day. Anyway, it's not a bad idea for that part of France, or part of near Alsace. And they have a little shop in town. I wanted to make them bourgeois. So if you can be like a movie director and you start out in space and you zoom in on this little town and Angelique and Pierre in their little cottage and the cows in the back and the shop in the front, and see what the Reformation meant to them. Thank you. I also, somebody provided me with a cough drop, so I hope we won't get into last night's troubles. But before we look very closely at Angelique and Pierre milking their cows and selling their cheese, we have to look at events far from them, and that's what I want to do too, that will affect their lives and the lives of their children and their children's children. This is what makes this city so interesting. The year is, guess what, 1530. A year with some significance to some of you, probably. And the place is? Yes. And the emperor is? We should go right through it, Charles V. And he was crowned about 2 months before, so he's fairly young. And of course, it's an imperial diet, and there are all these high ranking protesters who became Protestants. And had been making demands for some time that had been turned down. And these first Protestants happened to be dukes and electors, and among them Frederick, Duke of Saxony, whose seat was Wittenberg, and there, of course, he was protecting this troublesome monk from papal wrath. We know the story well, but I want to look at it from the perspective of politics and religion just for a little, as background to Angelique and Pierre. We acknowledge, Roman Catholic scholars as well as Lutheran preachers, that the Roman Catholic Church, the old church, or the church of the old believers, as it was called in the 1530s, had in many respects grown lax. There were fewer selfless mystics like Taula and more mischief makers like Tetzel. For every good superior like Staupitz, there were more greedy bishops like Albert of Mans. Worse, Clement VII was more interested in Renaissance art and the hunt than in the renewal of the church, and it was time for reform. In the beginning, I think that the protesting dukes were genuine in their support of the reform begun by Brother Martin. Frederick, Father Frederick, in 1518, still a collector of relics, as you remember, and a staunch protector of his people, understood less about Dr. Luther's theology than about a ruler's duties toward his subjects. The Pope asked Frederick to send Dr. Luther to Rome, had even bestowed upon him the golden rose, but Frederick understood too well that Luther would not return, and as his lord and protector, refused to send him. What began as the assertion of ducal right ended in Saxony's conversion to Protestantism. And who, without prolonged study of what I've just rehearsed so briefly, can sort out even this relatively simple religio-political situation? By 1529, the number of Protestant dukes and electors was almost equal to the Roman Catholic dukes and electors. What Charles V saw before him at Augsburg was a split empire, a divided diet. So to understand what led up to Augsburg, and all this really has to do with Angelique and Pierre, that's the amazing thing, we have to go back to the Council of Lateran V, which ended 6.5 months before Luther posted his theses. It was a papal council in Rome in the Lateran Palace. It was a council dominated by the Pope, who had won the battle against conciliarism, but none of the popes could forget the challenge of the conciliarists and resisted any move that might give conciliarism new life. And I think you all remember what conciliarism was and is. It was revived in Vatican II. It took a while, but it got revived. And some of the results of it are the strength of the American bishops as a body presently, and that's bothering the Pope and the Curia. Central control never likes control that's concentrated in an area away from the center, and that's really what conciliarism was about. Lateran V had a number of reform issues on its docket, but it really didn't accomplish much. I was always interested to know that one of the reforms on its docket was the missions in the New World. We have to remember the 16th century, things were going on over here too. So the reforms they enacted were not major, and they did not seek in relieving the situation. And part of the situation that needed reform was plurality of benefices, bishops and others, priests, having more than one parish, drawing revenues from it and sending in poorer folk, poorer priests, to do the work while they creamed off the money from it. And benefices, whether episcopal or sacerdotal, were in sources of income and control of property. So we're talking about money and power, not just doctrine. And we will see, doctrine itself is sometimes used to obtain power rooted in land and money. And that's what I mean by religion and politics in this period as well. So, because the council was not that effective, it was just a year before Luther called for a general free Christian council in German lands. And you know that call, which was repeated again and again, and finally Trent was called, much too late to serve the needs that Luther saw. So, at the Diet of Speyer in 1529, as you know, Charles agreed to tolerate the Lutheran form of the Mass, but already, and this is what I'm going to be working on here, he forbade the gathering of sacramentarians. And you all know who they are, right? Who's your local sacramentarian? You don't know who they are? Oh, okay. Those who denied the real corporal presence of Christ in the Eucharist, those Swiss. At this point, Calvin hadn't been converted yet or was in the process in 1529, but Zwingli was around. And as you know, Marburg, the colloquy of Marburg, took place shortly thereafter because the Swiss didn't like being called sacramentarians. It was a pejorative term. And as a matter of fact, this forbidding of the gathering of sacramentarians, the outlawing of sacramentarians, was one of the great problems of the 16th century for Protestants, who were not what those who came to be called Lutherans considered true followers of Augustana. They were the followers of the Variata edition, the one that allowed Calvin to sign the Augsburg Confession, although I have a professor who argues that Calvin signed the Invariata edition, but it has to do with the Lord's Supper. Article 10. So, actually, a Roman Catholic talking to Lutherans, but the people I'm really interested in are Calvinists. And that's what Angelique and Pierre are. But I want you to see what happens to them in the empire. That's where they are, even though they're French-speaking. And on the border of France. The condemnation of the Sacramentarians led to the Marburg Colloquy in the fall of 1529, and you know Philip of Hesse and Martin Bucer arranged it in the hope of uniting the Swiss Zwinglians with the German Lutherans against the Habsburgs, the family to which Charles V belonged. Now they're trying to get doctrinally together to get some political clout. This was not the first and not the last time religion would be used to try to realize the political aspirations of others. The colloquy failed to effect friendly tolerance, as you remember, especially with regard to the doctrine of the Lord's Supper. And the sad thing about 16th century, as I'm sure you realize, the doctrine which I have concentrated on in my study of theology has been the Lord's Supper throughout its history. And in the 16th century, it is the bone of contention throughout the whole period, amongst all. And you can ask yourself why. It's a doctrine that has to do with Christology, of course. But it's also connected with the liturgy. And at that liturgy, people come up to be counted, really. I mean, who you are and what you are, you declare when you go to communion. You say, I am in communion with all these people when you go to communion. At least in the 16th century, that was still the case. So, the sacramentarians, or the so-called sacramentarians, were outlawed in the empire. And this outlawing of the sacramentarians continued and was included in the Peace of Augsburg in 1555. The politically impotent Anabaptists were condemned also, but far more severely. They could be tried, condemned, and put to death by fire or sword without any trial. No questioning by a spiritual judge. Apart then from the Anabaptists and the Zwinglians, everyone in the empire was responsible before God for the form of his or her religion until a council could be called. Ecclesiastical properties which had already changed hands were to remain stable until a council should settle disputes. This last point was unsatisfactory, especially in towns in the midst of Reformation where they foresaw property changing hands, and led to the protest of 1529. But nevertheless, Protestants were able to gather and to celebrate Mass according to Luther's Mass by 1530. Why was so much yielded? Well, because of the political situation. I'm sure Charles V would not have yielded any of that had he been able to gather enough military force to overcome Protestant resistance. But he couldn't, so he had to yield. You know, he was facing the Turks in Austria and Hungary, and also with Catholic anti-Habsburg princes. It was divided within, okay? Now, I'm going to tell you some things that I don't want you to even try to remember, because it is so complex. But I think we have to understand this if we're going to see how these things, the wheeling and dealing in high places, come to bear on little people. The Bavarian Catholic princes, traditionally anti-Habsburg, were not sufficiently stable allies for Charles against those who professed a different kind of Christianity. Indeed, the Bavarians were willing to unite with Francis I of France, Charles V's enemy. They were always battling over something. In fact, they were having a war that caused the detour of Calvin. When he was on his way to Strasbourg, he stopped in Geneva, and you know what happened. And that was because Francis and Charles were having a battle. Francis was willing to use any means, including alliance with the Turks, to weaken Charles. Francis opposed a council which might bring religious unity to the empire. He didn't want the empire united, because then Charles could turn to France and give him grief. So Francis objected to every council that came along for 20 years. Paul III, the Pope, negotiated with the Turks. So you got Francis I negotiating with the Turks, you got the Pope negotiating with the Turks, you got Francis against the Pope, who, oh, really with the Pope, who wants, neither of them want a council very much. But Charles V wants a council because he's got to unite his empire. So only rarely did religion dominate in spite of politics, while religious convictions were too easily set aside for the sake of political expedience. Nor were the Protestants exempt from this judgment. The Schmalkald League, when it came into being, dealt with Roman Catholic Francis I and with the Turks. The Turks seemed to come into everybody's story against Charles, to the horror of Luther, who charged the princes with betraying both country and faith. So, that is really quite a mishmash. And now I want to get back to the little town. This little town has a history itself which makes it very complex. Angélique and Pierre were evangelical, that word. That's what they claimed. They weren't Lutheran, they weren't Calvinist, they weren't Zwinglian. They adhered to the gospel, they said, and were evangelical. And they agreed to the Augsburg Confession. According to Melanchthon's interpretation in 1540, the Variata. Part of their story, unknown to them, involved Augsburg in 1530. Now, what is their story? Right, Montbéliard, their town, belongs to the Duchy of Württemberg. And their Duke, Ulrich, was deprived of his duchy by the Swabian League in 1519, who sold it to Charles V, who turned it over to his brother Ferdinand. Now, what's happening to Pierre and Angélique while all this is going? Well, at this point, they're all Catholics, so it doesn't matter that much. But Ulrich lived in Montbéliard, and he caught on to the reform, but instead of bringing in somebody from Saxony, he went to Basel, talked to Ecolampadius, who was with Zwingli at the Council of Marburg, Colloquy of Marburg, and asked him to send a reforming preacher, which he did, William Farrell, a colleague of Calvin's later, arrived in 1524 and enjoyed a rapid success. In spite of the efforts of the Roman Catholic bishop, Montbéliard moved toward reform even after the departure of Farrell in 1525. But, now this is again, this is just going to kind of go past you, but look at all this complication. In order to finance his efforts to recover Württemberg, Ulrich sold Montbéliard to his brother George. Part of the condition on which Ulrich later regained his duchy was that he should not allow a single sacramentarian within its borders. This is by 1534. Ulrich agreed and went to work to introduce now the Lutheran Reformation. And Montbéliard, remember, was reformed by Farrell from Basel, Swiss Reformation. And the territory of Württemberg was not united. So Ulrich thought, well, sorry, I'll make them all happy. He put the northern part of the duchy under the Lutheran Erhard Schneff, and the southern half, including Tübingen, under Martin Bucer's friend from Constance, Switzerland, Ambrosius Blaue. The Swiss, including those in Basel, and also many of the South German towns under the Swiss influence, were unhappy with the outcome of the Marburg Colloquy, obviously, which labeled their reforms sacramentarian. And Blauer was their representative, and the Lutherans were not content with the choice of Blauer. As at Marburg, the chief problem was the doctrine of the Lord's Supper. When Ulrich regained his duchy in 1534, Melanchthon was already moving toward his Variata position of 1540, and found support from Bucer, who was about to meet with Luther for the 1536, I didn't write it down, so I've lost it. Help me out a minute. Wittenberg Concord. Okay? Wittenberg Concord. So, the lines were beginning to be drawn between those who would become the strict Lutherans and those who favored a less stringent doctrine with regard to the presence of the body of Christ in the Lord's Supper. And already even those followers of the Augsburg Confession who differed with the doctrine of the real bodily presence were in danger of being labeled sacramentarians. Blauer accepted the Augsburg Confession, but not Schnepf, the other guy in the duchy, not his understanding of it. Finally, in 1534, Blauer and Schnepf worked out a formula which both could live with. Now, this is not a formula which Angelique and Pierre would understand anything about, but I'll tell it to you anyway, because you all know what these words mean. We confess that the body and blood of the Lord is truly, that is, substantively and essentially, not however quantitatively, qualitatively, or locally present and offered. Try that on your local Angelique and Pierre. Okay, that's the kind of thing they were trying to work out. Meanwhile, little old Montbéliard was sold again with a right of repurchase on demand, this time sold to Francis I. Charles V said, no way. So Ulrich repurchased Montbéliard and he put it under the government of his brother George. George was Swiss Reformed. So that was fine for the people. And he brought in a pastor, Pierre Toussaint, who had been exiled from France for his faith and was a friend of Aequilin, Padius, and Farel, French, Swiss in influence. So Toussaint arrived in Montbéliard and promptly wrote them a church order, order of worship, and everything went along splendidly. Toussaint said he wanted to preach the gospel and not get into disputes about the Lord's Supper. Because of Toussaint's friendship for Farel and Blauer, Duke Ulrich became concerned that Toussaint was in the camp of the sacramentarians, and so his presence in Montbéliard was contrary to the treaty by which he had regained his duchy. No sacramentarians. Already under pressure from other Lutherans, Ulrich had let Blauer go and made Schnepf sole superintendent in the Duchy of Württemberg, so the Swiss influence has already been let go from the duchy. And he asked Toussaint to explain what he was doing. And Toussaint just said, I preached the gospel, but not according to Zwingli. Ulrich let it go under Count George, and Count George was happy with the Swiss slant of things in Montbéliard. But Ulrich needed Montbéliard for financial surety and said, goodbye, George, and put his son Christopher the Pious, to rule the county in 1542. Christopher is something of a Lutheran hero. People in Montbéliard may have seen it a little differently. He asked for the Württemberg Church Order, written by Schnepf and John Brentz, the theological leader and superintendent at Stuttgart. But Montbéliard said, no, Toussaint's written everything here we use, and this is what we're used to, and we're French speaking, and this is our liturgy, and this is our church order, and that's what we want to stick with. Among the new ordinances was that newborn infants in danger of death could receive emergency baptism from midwives. This is a Württemberg ordinance. Toussaint said, I don't know about that. And he wrote to Farel and Calvin. And Calvin told him and his ministers that it would be blasphemous and a sacrilege to allow women to administer baptism. Proper hiss. Yes, it was anti-women, but actually in the Reformed tradition, only ordained ministers could baptize. There was no need for emergency baptism because Calvin had a backup. To teach otherwise was to make the covenant and election of God dependent upon human actions, and predestination would take care of those kids. While it would be a serious sin to disregard the command to baptize, it is just as serious to allow women to do it, wrote Calvin. Other points were not so important, but on this Toussaint was advised not to relent. He could ring his church bells, but he couldn't let women baptize. Toussaint agreed and preached this doctrine to, among others, Angelique and Pierre. But meanwhile, Lutheran pastors had come in who would baptize and would enforce the Württemberg church order. The people of Montbéliard were deeply affected by this, and this actually happened. I've got letters to this effect and all kinds of things. So this is where we get the little axe that you said. Except that in slacks it doesn't come off so well, but nevertheless, okay. This is Angélique, you know, here she is. Okay. She says, "Hey, Pierre, we must go to Basel, get the mule. It's near my time." Pierre says, "I can't take the mule. It's time for spring planting." Angélique says, "But we have to obey God. What if my little child should, God forbid, die, and they were to have a midwife baptize it? We can't allow that. And we don't want those exorcisms either." "You're right, Angélique. I'll get the mule. We'll have to go at once." So off they go to Basel. She's in her 8th and a half month. People were doing this. And in other parts of the empire too, where this same rule was in effect, reformed people, little enclaves, were having to go elsewhere. Go to towns which were reformed, either because they were free cities in the empire or to go over the borders to have their children. And they did it. Right? It's just amazing if you think what their faith meant to them, that they would travel like this to be faithful to what they believed to be God's will for them. Christopher asked him and his ministers to send them a confession. This went on over and over. Send us a confession. Let us tell us what you're teaching there. He sent a very simple one, and he got away with it for a while. But then the real problem came out. Here he was, Swiss influence, writing letters to Calvin, a sacramentarian with regard to his doctrine of the Lord's Supper. No bodily presence, a spiritual presence. True, and Calvin would have said real, but he said the word's been co-opted. So true and spiritual presence. Christ truly offered to all, but received only by the faithful, not by the unworthy. No oral mandication. That's the big thing. They really disagreed about that. So that made him a sacramentarian. That made him illegitimate in the empire. That's where the thing comes down to bear. These people were subject to being banned. From 1544 on, Toussaint led the ministers of Montbéliard in an exhausting, unrelenting battle to retain their own church order. But after 1559, the Württemberg Confession, written by Brentz with its doctrine of a corporal presence of the body of Christ, backed by his doctrine of ubiquity, was imposed. The situation was exacerbated when refugees from the French Wars of Religion, another political religious situation, if there ever was one, sought refuge in this French-speaking border town of Montbéliard. So now you've got French Calvinists in this town, independently reformed, who disagree with Lutherans on the Lord's Supper, but disagree with the Calvinists on predestination. They all believed in single predestination, as Basil did. But they really were a fairly independent group. So we could go on with these complications. I think maybe you've seen it enough to believe that it really was terribly difficult. But it's even greater than that, and we'll look at it in a minute or two, because it involves not just, I mean, here's poor little Pierre and Angélique, really. What do they want to do? They want to go to communion in the church order they had adopted when they were first reformed, and I mean, they weren't about to be reformed 3 or 4 times. And that's really all they wanted, go to communion in their own church order and have their children baptized in their own town. Who was involved in testing what this town should be? Would you believe Queen Elizabeth of England, Henry III of France, Philip II of Spain, the Pope and Emperor Rudolf II? All of them. I'll tell you about it a little later. What's going on with Angélique and Pierre? So we'll zoom in on them again. We've understood now how they came to be reformed and what their problem was in the empire. Their daily life was affected, not only when they wanted to go to communion, not only when they were having children, but their schools. The catechism in the school, the schoolmasters had to sign a confession. So here they were teaching their kids at home what they believed, but the kids had to go to school and learn something else. Now, that's a problem some people think we're having now. So the interweaving of religion and politics is not only unavoidable, it is not only ubiquitous, given human nature, but it is something which directly affects the lives of the folk, the little people, whose primary desire is the peaceful enjoyment of their homes, their towns, and their way of life. And their way of life includes their church ordinances as well as the laws of their government. So Angélique and Pierre, their native Montbéliardais, proud of their town and the privileges it has obtained from its counts through a history of faithful service. How painful for this couple to see their little county sold to France, back to Ulrich, especially after having been taken over by Austria. It was politically confusing enough, but at least before the advent of the Reformation, these political changes meant little with regard to their religion. But after the reform of Farel, the confusion in their lives becomes more intimate. Angélique and Pierre had been loyal to the old church. They heard Farel and, won over by his preaching, adopted his reform. Under Ulrich, for a while, things went smoothly. Then, under George, that was all right too. Under Christopher, some problems, and then George's son Frederick was up for count. But he had been carefully educated at Tübingen by his uncles, who took over his education when Count George died, too young, unfortunately for him. And at Tübingen was a Lutheran whose name some of you may know, if you know your confessional history, Jakob Andreae. How many know who he is? Was. Some people are not quite sure. One of the formulators of the Formula of Concord, and of the major formulators, one of the most ardent in propagating it hither and yon. So, Frederick had been tutored by Brentz and Brentz's protege, Andreae. Okay, now it's Brentz who draws up the Württemberg Church ordinances, and by now Pierre and Angélique have had their children, Armand and Lisette. And Armand and Lisette have married, and they have small children. And they have never known, nor will their children, nor their grandchildren know a time in their lives when their religion was not contested. When Armand and Lisette were little and Frederick was a baby, Charles V signed the Peace of Augsburg and retired to a monastery. Now the policy of no sacramentarians was universalized throughout the empire. Only those following the Augsburg Confession and Roman Catholics were allowed in the empire. Sacramentarians were banned, and some claimed, like Andreae, to be the legitimate adherents of the Augsburg Confession, the Invariata, 1530 edition, not the 1540 edition, decided that that should be used as the touchstone of legitimate citizenship for Protestants in the empire. So you've got a terrible division within Protestantism now. The Palatinate was struggled over. That's a whole other history of the Palatinate, which went Lutheran, Calvinist, back and forth. And the effort to get the Calvinist ruler of the Palatinate declared illegal because he was a Calvinist and contra, and therefore a sacramentarian, was intense. Pierre's family looked to their ministers for guidance. The ministers looked to Pierre Toussaint. Toussaint said, "I'm just an evangelical preaching the gospel. I believe in the true presence of Christ. I don't believe in oral mendication." Nor did he believe that anyone lacking faith truly received the body and blood of Christ. And he said, "I'm following Martin Bucer and Melanchthon by now," Melanchthon had died meanwhile, but had seemed to have swung round to that sort of position, possibly, for a while, at least in the 1541 Variata edition. So, he also claimed that the Wittenberg Concord, as explained by Bucer, which Luther signed, was a basis for their belief. And that's a very interesting thing, because it looks like Luther signed something which also said that the unworthy do not receive the body of Christ, which is quite interesting. But this declaration of Protestant faith would not do. Duke Christopher demanded conformity. When Angelique and Pierre died in 1565, the matter was not settled. Armand and Lisette and their children still sided with the French refugees who began to come in now that the wars of religion, which had begun in 1562, drove out many French exiles. The French refugees, already derisively called Calvinists and Huguenots, shared the belief on the Lord's Supper and differed on predestination. But they agreed to agree and not to emphasize their disagreement on predestination, although that will come in a little bit later. Another area of concern, of course, was education of children. So they looked to Count Frederick when he reached his majority and came back to be count. They said, look, he's got George for a father. Count George was reformed. Surely the boy will remember his father in spite of Tübingen. Frederick winked at his uncle. Now the Duke of Württemberg is Ludwig. Demands. On the other hand, Frederick was young and insecure, and he was not too bright from some of the letters he wrote. He had to maintain order in his county, so he told the Montbéliard folk they weren't to go to Basel, ostensibly to the fair, but really to receive communion from a reformed minister. Nor were they women to go to Basel and have their babies. But worse was to come. In 1577, the formula of Concord was promulgated, and Jacob André was Johnny on the spot. Now, Count Frederick, meanwhile, had been chastised by his uncle Ludwig and Emperor Rudolf II for harboring French refugees, because neighboring Roman Catholic towns, Rudolf II being Catholic, of course, had written letters of complaint, as had Henry III of France, who didn't like the idea of Huguenots on the French border. He thought they might come back with guns and form an army. And to some of these complaints, bright Frederick wrote, there are no French men in Montbéliard, and besides, those that are here have wives and children with them. There it is. I thought that was pretty good. And he sent that letter off to John Casimir of the Palatinate and said, is this okay? And Casimir said, I'll write a letter to go with it. Frederick decided his political bread was buttered on the Lutheran side and demanded that all ministers and schoolmasters sign the formula of Concord or lose their jobs. Because that affected nearly all of them, Frederick had to think again. And what he did is call for a colloquy between Jacob André and Calvin's successor, the guy I studied, this is how I got into this, Theodore Beza. And they were to come and have a colloquy and decide whether the people of Montbéliard could indeed go to communion. They'd already been denied communion at Christmas time under their own liturgy, but at Easter, because they said, please, can't we? And Frederick said, oh, I don't know, we got to really check this out. So he invited Beza, but the one who invited André was fascinating. It's a man named Le Baron de Clairvaux. I chased over Europe for 3 years trying to find out why the Baron de Clairvaux, who turns out to be one of the chief aides of Henry of Navarre. Henry of Navarre was the leader of the Huguenot forces in France and would become Henry IV, becoming a Catholic on the way. No religion and politics there, of course. Well, what was the Baron de Clairvaux doing inviting André to be one of the collocutors at this little colloquy in Montbéliard that has to do with Armand and Lisette and their kids going to communion? What was Henry of Navarre doing in this? Well, I thought, well, Henry of Navarre and John Casimir, I mean, they're sort of all Calvinists, so maybe that's what it's about. But as I chased it around, I discovered a very interesting thing. In the meantime, in England, what was Elizabeth doing? What has Elizabeth got to do with Armand and Lisette in this little tiny town on the borders of France? Elizabeth had sent no less than Sir Philip Sidney, who's in this part of his career, those of you who enjoy his poetry or know something about literature may not know anything at all, sent him as her ambassador to the King of Denmark and the princes of Brandenburg and other duchies in Protestant duchies in Germany to form a Protestant League against the Holy League, which is Philip II, the Pope, and the Emperor, and all those folks. A Protestant League. And guess what she ran into? King of Denmark said, okay, not a bad idea. Hanseatic cities, she went to them too. Hanseatic cities said, well, it's not a bad idea, but we're sending supplies to all sides in this war. Our ships are going here and there, and you know, I'm not sure we can go along with this. We're certainly not going to put an embargo on shipments to France. So, anyway, the Protestant dukes, the Lutheran dukes in Germany, had already been talking with, guess who? The Guise. You know who the Guise are? They were the heavy Roman Catholic, ultra-Roman Catholic, advisors of Henry III, the King of France. And the Guise said, we believe in the real presence. We believe in oral mandication. You believe in those things. These Calvinists don't. You help us. And they did. The Duke of Brandenburg was sending troops and supplies into France to help the Roman Catholics against the Calvinists. Not only that, but their theologians were writing all kinds of things like what demons and devils these Calvinists were. I mean, who else could have inspired such an ungodly doctrine that would deny the bodily presence of Christ in the Eucharist? So, they talked about it. Hesse was in favor of Elizabeth. He tried to support her. Of course, John Casimir was. In fact, he was leading troops into France to fight on the other side, paid by Elizabeth, £100,000. So, now what's all this got to do with Clairvaux going to André to go to the colloquy? I'm convinced that this colloquy was the final effort, the last ditch, to prove to Lutherans that Calvinists were close enough to them in the doctrine of the Eucharist and by now Christology, which became even more of a problem, that these Lutheran princes should cease to support the Roman Catholic troops in France and come to the rescue of the Huguenots. While Armand and Lisette thought that all they were doing was having a theological dispute which would settle the problem of their going to communion, the crowned heads of Europe were looking upon this to find out if maybe Lutherans and Calvinists, Protestants, could merge against Roman Catholics. And the answer was no. Melior Jesuita quam Calvinista, said Andrea. Better a Jesuit than a Calvinist. Things had gone pretty far. And behind the Lord's Supper, Beza came to discuss the Lord's Supper, but that rapidly went to Christology and the two natures doctrine. And Rick Lisher said something about the communication of idioms in his lecture this morning, and that was anathema to the Calvinists. The divine attributes could be communicated to the person of Christ, but not to the human nature. And that was the bone of contention between the Calvinists and the Lutherans. Now, I ask you, how many of your parishioners would know anything about that? How many of you remember anything about that? Really? And here are these people's lives depending on this sort of thing. Well, then they pushed it further, and against Beza's protest, he said he wasn't prepared to discuss predestination. But anyway, he gave the Calvinists double predestination. And then the ministers in Montbéliard said, uh-uh, we're not with that. It all went sour. And Frederick turned Lutheran. It was 100 years from the time of their reform by the Swiss Farrell before that little town was finally Lutheran. For the next, this is 1586, 400 years ago this colloquy took place, 1586, it was 1627 before the Calvinists in Montbéliard, or the Reformed in Montbéliard, gave up going elsewhere for communion to have their babies and to write confessions and send them to the Duke and say, will this do? Will this do? Will this? And the Duke would write back and say, don't send me anymore. You've got the confession you're to have. Look at the Book of Concord. It's all there. I say, we don't want that. But that's it, folks. And the interesting thing is that a young man from Montbéliard wrote a dissertation at the University of Geneva, and what he defended was Calvinist doctrine of the Lord's Supper and what you might call Lutheran doctrine of predestination. So in 400 years, the memory went back, and he was still defending the same thing. You may know or you may not that every time a French Calvinist in the Wars of Religion appealed to the German dukes for assistance, they said, what do you think of the Lord's Supper? Every time. And whenever they said, a real or true spiritual presence, no oral mendication, the German Duke said, sorry, and refused to assist. And if that isn't a mix-up of political and religious affairs, I can't think of any that is a little more, any more clear. We could go on and on about other intrigues and political maneuvers all over Europe, but I think you probably have got the point. So, what we've looked at is emperors, kings, princes, and dukes aligning themselves not according to religion. I mean, the funny thing is, they'll turn to the Turks, but they won't align with the Calvinists. It's really very strange, these kinds of things. I guess because cousins often disagree more violently than people who are not related. But history, I think, is a great teacher. The people of Montbéliard really suffered because the law of the empire was interpreted to support those who became known as Lutherans and Roman Catholics. And it was because of situations like this that the First Amendment was appended to our Constitution. A lot of those Huguenots, after all, came to the United States. And if you look into any Huguenot genealogy, and my, but they do enjoy genealogies, as I discovered when I tried to do some work on them. George Washington was a Huguenot. Paul Revere was a Huguenot. They were all Huguenots. They had quite an influence over here. And that's what we want to look at tomorrow, religion and politics in the 20th century and in this country. And I'd like to tell you just a couple more things now. About the fireside first, there are three things that I can do with you and am willing to do any or all of them. My specialization, I think you've heard something of. That's where I've been working. Medieval Reformation theology, sacramental theology, theology of grace, sacraments, spirituality, they're all connected. And we can talk about any of those things that you might want to. The dialogue, if you're interested in the Roman Catholic Lutheran dialogue, or explore with you politics and religion further. But I don't want you to direct a lot of questions at me because I am not an expert about it in its present state. The reason that I am talking about it is partly because of what I've just shared with you from my studies. But putting that into the 20th century in this country is another matter. I'm not an expert on that. I wanted to start the conversation because I think we have to talk about it in this country. And I think that probably you, many of you, maybe all of you, have as good or better ideas than I do about what we have to do in this country. And the fireside would then be something like what this country was founded on, a discussion of real issues, about which we may then conclude differently. But I want to hear your thoughts. I want to go on thinking about this. And at the fireside too, and I hope Ismael will come, because he raised a point while we were walking that I think is very important. Everything I have said last night and tonight was from the point of view of European North American understanding of religion, spirituality, and so on. And Ismael said, it may be different. Can the oppressed allow pluralism? Is it an option for them? Can they assert one point of view actively, even aggressively? What would spirituality support for those people? Wouldn't it be different? And I think it would, and I'm not just sure where to go with that, but I think we have to fold it into the mix and be aware that the world is larger than those patterns and that history with which we are more familiar, perhaps.